one or another of the website. But yeah, I need to remember to do that.
It's called How Far Are We From the Quantum Theory of Gravity. It's really good because it's just kind of a synopsis of all the different routes that a lot of people have taken and what the problems are with the convergence of, with perturbation theory of general relativity and things like that. So, but in here, he talks a little bit about the difference between, or he points out this fact that the expansions, the perturbative expansions that we get in quantum field theory are asymptotic and not convergent. And so I'm going to tell you guys about what that means. So we're going to talk about asymptotic series. And we're going to start with just by looking at some functions that we are going to approximate with a series. That could be a Taylor series. In the paper, he is really careful to not say that this is a power series, but most of the time, when we actually do anything and calculate it, it will be a power series. So this is some function of x times coefficients, just like any other expansive series that we would use. And the idea is to look at this as x goes to some fixed value. And this fixed value can be anything. We look at this in general. It could be x goes to 0. It could be x goes to some x that we want to evaluate it at. And a lot of times, if it's a 1 over something like a 1 over x to the n type series, then this will be as x goes to infinity, positive infinity. Okay. So I looked around, and he gives one definition of what an asymptotic series is. I looked at probably 10 different sources, and I found like 8 different definitions of what an asymptotic series is. Like the easiest one to work with that I can get to a lot of the others from this definition is that if I look at this thing, this actually should be infinity, not maybe I'm not. So the idea is that as that actually goes to infinity, that these two things are equal to each other. We're not really sure about that. As I take the difference between this, as I go to some fixed n, so certain number of terms in this series, if the difference between these two, the absolute value of it, is smaller than, so people use this notation, I'm going to write down this way just so that you guys look any of this stuff up, you'll understand what they're talking about. Phi sub n. And so there's two O's. There's a big O and a little O, and this is the little O. And this means smaller than the order of whatever's in the parentheses. And big O means on the order of whatever's in the parentheses. So this is really smaller than phi sub n. That's the way to look at this, and remember this is some function of x. Okay, and so that's the definition that the mathematicians use. That's the definition that Poincaré used, who's the one who came up with these in the first place. And so his definition is that you have this difference over the n minus 1 term, and that. When I take that difference and I divide it by the n minus 1 term as this goes to that, whatever that fixed value is. So let me write down his different definition, but it makes sense from this because we were talking about this the other day and we couldn't figure it out. So as x goes to some x0, I'm just going to call this s of n, this sum. So the limit of s of x, the difference between these guys, over phi sub n minus 1 of x equals 0. So it just means that this difference is smaller than the than the second to last term in the series. So if this is correct, then that's basically correct as well. Do you guys see that? So let me make sure. So let's see. If this is smaller than the very last term, then the second to last, the idea is that the second to last term is bigger than these terms are supposed to get smaller and smaller as you go along, this, whatever this order term is.
So we're dividing by something bigger. All right. So does this equation say that basically at x zero the function is the same as that theory?
No, it's not saying it's the same. Well, yes, that's what it's saying. Because the other thing that people say, and this is another definition, is, and these are all really subtly different, and I can't pick apart a lot of the pieces, that the limit as x goes to x zero of, so people call this thing the difference between these, the remainder. So when you're talking about series approximation zero, it's looking at what the remainder is, what's the difference between the function and the sum as the sum goes to infinity. And just that this equals zero means that it's an asymptotic series. That's another definition that I've seen. And so there's some, I mean, these are all just like very slightly different, and it's really difficult to tell. This one is the easiest to work with and the one I saw the most.
Yeah.
I feel like these two are very similar to each other and are a tighter bound on something that you're looking at, where this is a more general definition of what it is. This is a more stringent restriction than this.
Yeah, one thing that's helpful when you're trying to sort something like this out is to do a less general case.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, for example, a power series or an inverse power series, something like that, and see if you understand it in that limit. You know, because there you can see like phi. We don't know what phi is.
Right.
You know, but if we're doing 1/x, then what is phi? Well, it's 1/x-1. Right. And so we can look at this and tell, oh, it is less or it isn't less or it is or isn't going to zero. I don't know what x naught really is here. I'm still...
Like, so we can take it to be infinity. Let's try the power series. Like, let's just work it out. But let's pick a function. What can I... A good function to pick for...
Well, the only example I know is the one in Twitter.
Right. Okay, well, that's the next thing I'm going to do is talk about the example.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, you might remind these guys of what a convergence series is.
Okay.
I mean, we've been talking about this a little bit, but
the big thing with...
Bring these guys up to speed.
The big thing with the asymptotic series is that when you're looking at limits of anything, you're looking at x. As x goes to some value, whether it's x goes to 0, x goes to infinity, or some fixed value, but n is always fixed, so you're not adding any more terms in the series. And when you look at a convergence series, the convergence series is that, this difference here, so r sub n, in the limit as n goes to infinity, r sub n equals 0. So the difference between the two. So this is a convergent series, asymptotic series, has to do with fixed n and a limit of x as you go to some x, whatever that is. So they're looking at two slightly different things, and something can be asymptotic and convergent, and so people, do you want to take pictures on, or?
I'm
not used to people taking pictures on right now, so. Okay, so, There's nothing that says that the series will even go to this function. So there's three things they can do. It can either converge to f of x. It can converge to some other function g of x that's not equal to f of x. And it can diverge. So it can do any of those things, and there's nothing saying that we start writing this down. And I'm going to go through an example in a second of where one of the main ways that people get these asymptotic series. And you can tell from that often what it's actually going to do. Okay. So let's do that. Let's do what are the examples that you have. And in fact, I've found this example that people use. There's only two functions that people ever use as an example for f.
And what's the other one?
The error function.
Uh-huh.
So.
We should try them both, see if we understand it.
This one, people call it e sub 1 of x, is it's an integral from x to infinity of e to the minus t over t. So that's just the definition. This is what people call the exponential integral.
Oh, okay.
Can you prove that that exists for all positive x? This is relevant, right? Because, all right, we're claiming that our path integrals are going to be an asymptotic series to something. And so we're going to develop a series expression for this thing that is asymptotic. You know, it doesn't converge. And it's easy to get the feeling from that, like, does this thing exist at all? Well, it does, and it's easy to prove that for any positive x, that expression is bounded.
Okay.
All right? You see how to do it?
No. I've never taken an analysis class, so.
Okay. That integral is bounded by 1 over x times the integral of e to the minus t.
Oh, right. Well, because
the smallest the denominator ever gets is x. So you can replace the t in the denominator by x. Pull it out of the integral, and that gives an upper bound to the integral.
We're
and then the integral of e to the minus t is some point, I think,
too. We're going to do the same thing in a second. Yeah, because I can do it by, I have to take the, another way of doing that is, if I take the, if I integrate this by parts, right?
Uh-huh.
So I integrate by parts, and I'll get over t as evaluated from x to infinity, and then what is the other part here? So minus e to the minus t, the derivative of this is t over, or t squared, and there's a minus 1 in there. There's a minus from the integral, and then so there's a minus from this, from if this is my du. Right, so u is negative e to negative t, b equals 1 over t, so dv equals negative 1 over t squared. So there's 1, 2 negatives, and then the negative out front, so it ends up just being 1 negative. And so this is bounded by this function, right? Because this is the function that's inside this integral. So this ends up being e to the negative negative x. And maybe this isn't showing it, but this is what. Sort of the same idea. So this thing is always.
That's right.
That's
okay. Everybody see it?
Mm-hmm. But can I use this as an argument for it being bounded because this is always greater than, or it's always less than this?
I'm looking for that second thing's positive.
What's that?
As long as that second thing's always positive.
It's always like, well, as long as x is positive, I guess.
Right, for all of
it. Yeah. Yeah.
What do we know?
For positive x, that thing's going to be positive. So on negative, for positive x, negative has a one.
That thing's got to be
positive. Well, even x is negative, right? It's still positive, I think.
So what's your argument that this shows it down?
I have no argument. I'm trying to understand because I have no idea how to think about it.
So
what you said about most of the hard material didn't make any sense to me, so I'm hoping this one makes more sense.
Oh, okay. So, all right, so our original integral is positive. And we've written it as e to the minus x over x, which is also positive, minus something, which is positive.
Right.
So, let's see. If you bring this negative term over, so our original integral plus the second term here has to be equal to e to the minus x over x. But since this second integral is positive, the original integral has to be less than e to the minus x over x. So there's a proof of this.
Okay.
That's one way to do it. But you didn't understand what I was saying?
Because he uses that argument later on.
Yeah, just real quick. So we've got integral of x to infinity, e to the minus t over t dt. Alright, I'm claiming that in this integral, right, over this range of integration, t is always greater than x, right, because the lower limit is x.
Mm-hmm.
So this has to be less than the integral from x to infinity of e to the minus t over x. Since x is smaller than t, this thing's going to be bigger than this thing.
Oh, okay.
Right? But x is constant, so just pull it out, and now integrate e to the minus t dt, and that's just the exponential. That's just
it'll end up being e to the minus x.
Yeah, e to the minus x. So that's the same balance.
Okay, so this is one way in which...
It doesn't hold for negative x, correct?
No, well, x equals zero at divergence, right? So negative x is just minus this function. No, you've got a positive exponential.
Right.
So negative x,
you got an ugly little thing that's going to diverge because that thing stays positive and that thing goes negative.
Yeah, negative x, you don't want to integrate to. You don't want to integrate over the pole at zero unless you know what happens there.
Right.
And then you don't want to go clear to negative infinity because that's clearly going to diverge. But otherwise, you can get sensible negative values except for that pole at zero. But, let's press on. Think of it as a function for positive x.
So this is a way that people often look at asymptotic theories for a function is that you have some integral and you continually do integration by parts. And this is a common way to get an asymptotic theory. And I can do... Well, here. I can either show you guys. Do you guys want to do one more step, and then I can show you the series. So we end up getting e to the minus x over x, and then we're going to get minus e to the minus x over x squared. So we'd end up getting, it'd be minus e to the minus t over t squared, right? Because now I'm saying that t squared is my v. You guys see that? And then, hold on. Yeah, there's two minus signs, so this ends up being a plus. And then,
just going to keep going with that, right?
What's that? And then you just keep going with that, right? So then the next term ends up being, there's a 2 now because I took this derivative of 1 over t squared, and that cancels. It ends up being positive. I just checked another time. So dt, and then this is e to the minus t over t cubed. And so then we can write down this series out of t. And you write this way out. I don't know if I would have picked, but. These are all going to keep adding up to be, and then
is it alternating in sine?
Should it be 0,
1?
Yeah, sure. First term should be yeah.
Minus.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, and then both parts are alternating in sine, and this one is a. Big N now, big N factorial, x to infinity of that. So that's just this. Both of these will be every other term. They alternate. Okay, so this is. An asymptotic series. Let's prove that it's an asymptotic series.
Alan.
Hello.
Okay. So this is S sub n. Again, this is the sum. So this is what we're saying is that this is the asymptotic series, and this is some remainder. So this extra part over here is what I was calling before is R sub n. And so all we have to do is show something about R sub n to show that it's an asymptotic series, to show that the difference is on the order or smaller than the order of the last term of this series. So subtract those two things. This is what R sub n is. I'm going to not look at the alternating parts because it's all an absolute value, so that part doesn't matter. So,
yeah, that time works really well.
Same argument that actually you just gave down here. This is what the R sub n, which is this part of the function model, proportional to R sub n without the sign change. This is less than, like you were saying a second ago, right? If I change the t to an x because x is always less than t over the range of the integral, then 1 over x to the n plus 1 times and then we can integrate that, and so we should get a function here, so that ends up being the
minus sign of it when you take the limit at the end of getting a positive sign of it. So this, so now we know the remainder is less than this, this function here. And remember what we have to show is that f of x minus s of n of x, which is equal to r of n, is less than the order of that slice of n. So what we're looking at is not the whole. We're looking at the x. This is the function of x, and then it comes with some coefficient on it. Right? So the now we got to go back to this. And e to the minus x, n minus 1, x to the n plus 1 gives us x over n. So we're comparing it to that last slice of n, which is equal to e to the minus x over x to the n. And it and lo and behold, this r sub n is less than this, and this is definitely less than that. So remember the
triangle in the plug.
What's that?
Did you lose an n factorial here? Is there another n factorial or n minus 1 factorial?
There is an n minus 1 factorial, but remember that
but it's just the phi.
It's just the phi, not the coefficient.
Good. Alright.
So, and it's all on the order of it, right? It's all defined like on the order of this or that. So, this is the example he uses in trying to show that.
So the statement is, if we take the ratio of the expression in the box to this last expression and take the limit as x goes, in this case, to infinity, that goes to 0. And it does.
It does.
Right? As 1 over x, e to the minus x.
Yes.
Cool. So what's the problem? What's the problem?
The problem with
n. Why is this not convergent?
Okay, so, I mean, it's not convergent because if I fix n and take the limit as x goes to infinity, it works. But if n goes to infinity, then
to show that it's not
convergent.
So, at some fixed value of x,
then when I go here,
it goes to infinity, it goes to 1.
But look at the equation in the box. Oh.
In
factorial. Yeah, in factorial. So the what is that? The remainder term, all right, for fixed x is going to diverge as you keep adding terms. That's the problem we're running into. So this n factorial, if you look at Stirling's formula for n factorial, it's n to the n times e to the minus n times some correction stuff. So basically n to the n. So the nth remainder term looks like, roughly n over x to the n. And if n gets bigger than x for some fixed x, now your series starts to diverge. As you keep adding terms, it gets worse.
Right, so the general conclusion is that when you only want to go to as many terms as n is to 1 over x, because of it. But if you end up adding like n plus 1 over x every single term you add, but the n factorial. So I found something that was really cool, so we can go through this. This is a numerical. Way of looking at things. Okay.
So it starts on the right side of this, but this is a mathematical journal. It's about teaching, but different ways to teach things to people. So, and Woodard actually does this. At the bottom of this first page on the right, there's a convergence series approximation, which you can find from this form of the exponential integral. And he's doing x times e to the x. X times e to the x times the exponential integral is everything that he does in here. And I can see why he does that, just to get rid of some of the different things in terms.
Now, that series is for small labs, right? Or actually, that converges for all x.
So. Yeah, I think so. The convergence series converges for all x, but it converges better for small x.
Yeah.
So, what Stockwell here is basically trying to show to folks is that why do we want to use an asymptotic series is not that it's absolutely correct and that it converges, is that often asymptotic series will converge more quickly as long as you only do a few of the terms, right? So you can use like four terms, and after using four or five terms, the series will actually be more, or will be closer to the real value than a convergence series will. So they'll be much closer than a convergence series will converge, but there's nothing saying how fast it will converge. So a lot of convergence series actually converge really slowly, and so that's what he goes through in these cases. The first part, he shows you how close the convergence series is. Mathematica has different software to pick out what the exponential integral actually as many decimal places as you want it to. It has a completely different program to do that. He's also, in later calculations, this ends up important, he's turned off the controls that Mathematica has on like floating point errors in computers, and so that's what he ends up showing, is that the convergence series, in the end, it converges so slowly that you get floating point errors and it goes completely awry. And the asymptotic series, after only five terms, gives you almost the same number to convergence that Mathematica has in a special program where it knows how to calculate this as exactly as possible. So, besides quantum field theory, people use asymptotic series often numerically because the asymptotic series is easier to implement an algorithm for. So after five or six terms, you get convergence to what you want. You get the right number of significant figures. Whereas with a convergence series, it might take you, here you've got on page 55, he goes out to like 61 terms to get as many significant figures as he wants, and then in 20 terms he has the same number.
He never quite reaches. The term 8 is about as big as. He gets the first three digits.
Right. It's not until the last page where the asymptotic series shines. So that's where he's getting the numerical errors in the convergence series, and that's the asymptotic series is converging after five terms to the right number to six significant figures, basically. So that's just another way that these are useful. Makes the point that you can't define your quantum theory using its perturbative solution, but it's a good place to start. And that QED the expansion is all about what alpha is, but it actually is alpha over pi. So this is 137 or this is 1 over 37 times pi on the bottom, so it ends up being about 1 over 430. And using the same idea, so we were talking about this right before class, but so for this series solution, it ends up being n when n is proportional to about 1 over x. And we're saying that since these are mostly power series, most power theories will have about the same type of convergence, and when not convergence, they'll have the same type of error when you get to the same factor of n, right? So if we take that into account, it ends up being that when n is about 430, so and n, remember, in our QED is how many points there are on a Feynman diagram, right? So this thing, how many vertices there are in the Feynman diagram. So when we get to 430 vertices, that's when the solution fails. That's when we start getting things that diverge. And he does a quick calculation using Stirling's approximation and comes out to like 10 to the negative 187 is the precision that you can get. You know, 429 turns, you get 10 to the negative 187 is the precision that you get with this. These approximations, and he makes the point that we can measure to about 10 to the 4 or 10 to the 5, but it seems like we can measure bigger than that.
With Spitzer strings, you can do n equals 6.
Okay.
N equals 5, I think, takes a supercomputer a few months.
Okay.
But with the Twister strings, you can get it down to like 20 integrals or something.
Okay.
So it's not bad at all.
Right.
So you can push a little further that way.
But not
430. Now, you know how many Feynman diagrams you could draw? 430 vertices. Yeah, homework for tomorrow. Draw all the 430 vertex Feynman diagrams in OED.
Oh my God.
Yeah, I think that goes up faster than end to the end. I'm not sure. Topologies go up fast.
End
to the 2N or whatever? Yeah, it'd be fun to do an estimate of the number of Feynman diagrams. I don't know how to do that. But yeah,
can we do it from...
It's a topological thing.
Yeah.
But
can we do it from 2? How many do we get from 2 the other day?
2 vertices? What, in QED? I
don't know. QED is only a 3. We did it. We were doing it for 5, 4.
And, you know, you get up to, you know, several diagrams. I think by the time you go to 4 diagrams, you're getting up around 15 or 20. I mean, up to 4 vertices.
So QED is analogous, at least, in drawing diagrams to 5 cubed, right? So,
the diagram is probably the purple version.
So for n equals 1, QED is whatever, but do we want to take into account photons going in, photons coming out, like how many is n equal 1
that gives. Well, let's hold the initial and final condition 6.
Okay.
If we send, why don't we send one electron in and have one electron come out? I guess we better have a photon come out too. So just a simple emission.
Okay.
And let's figure out how many ways that can happen as we add.
That's it, right? Or is there 2 there? How many do we want to...
Let's call that 1.
Okay.
So... we probably need to go up by even numbers, actually. Let's look at anything that can happen with one incoming electron, regardless of the final state.
Okay.
So we could probably get 2 photons out. Yeah. and you could dress your propagator with a photon absorption, you know, emission and absorption. So just take one electron line straight through and have it emit a photon and reabsorb the same photon. Yeah. If you do that. Okay, I don't know. Anything else? There aren't too many more here. Anybody think of any others? Maybe we could cross these various electrons, so we get a few different things that way. Yeah.
All right. Do you have any tadpoles?
What's that?
No tadpoles?
Oh, I don't know. Do we have any tadpoles here? Let's see. Well, they used to get tadpoles with a triple vertex. That happened with the 5-4 theory. Right, so the same interaction point emits and absorbs. So let's try N equals 3. What did we get at N equals 3? So take an electron, let it emit a photon, let that photon pair create. And then that pair can annihilate again and give a photon.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
So there's one.
Can't one of the lights from the photon get back with the first original electron and annihilate that way too?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, okay, so the same diagram, except take the positron back to the initial electron line and let those two annihilate.
Just one of those guys?
Yeah, start off the same way. Yeah, now pair create. But, go ahead.
So like this?
No.
No.
The other one. Take that one off to the final state.
Gotcha.
But, yeah, bring the positron over there and get a photon.
Okay.
And then, yeah, take that off to the final state. There you go. Okay. This is fun. Before we get too far astray, does anyone have questions on convergence and asymptotic theory? You get the idea here? I was wondering why they always talk about this ratio, but it's a finer distinction, right? So we know that numerator goes to zero for large x, but by saying that it's less than the nth term here, that constrains it much more.
Right.
So, so it's a stronger condition to say that Rn has got to be less than this thing, or that the limit of x goes to infinity. Right. Because as x goes to infinity, Rn is going to zero, you know, exponentially over x to the n. I mean, that's really fast.
Yeah.
But the ratio of these two is going to zero, the exponential goes away, and you're just left with 1 over x. So that's a much more delicate condition to match.
Which ratio the Rn has?
So the thing we want to look at is the thing in the box over this e to the minus x over x to the n. All right, the ratio of the thing in the box to the nth term there, phi n. All right, that ratio, as x gets large, goes to zero much slower. But that's enough to tell you you've got an asymptotic theory. So I guess there's no real telling what happens to these things when you get n bigger. I mean, this example oscillates, right?
Yeah, it oscillates, and then there is no...
And bigger and bigger and oscillating.
...that says anything about... There's nothing but numerics that tell you when... I mean, I guess this does, but, like, there's nothing that tells you how... Sorry. There's nothing that tells you how close you are to the series you're trying to approximate. And then no one's figured anything out.
Uh-huh.
So you can have some idea of when it blows up and when you won't get any closer, but you won't know how close you are at that point. You don't know how...
So what if you were to combine the two things by... suppose you know that you're going to want a good approximation near x naught, some finite value of x. So you know you can use an asymptotic series up to that point. So what if you took, you run your asymptotic series up until n is right near x naught. Then you take the difference between that and your actual function and expand that in a positive Taylor series.
Hmm.
And try and get the quickly converging Taylor series, you know, once you use the asymptotic series to get you close.
Close, right.
Think you could do that? We should try that. You know, on some of these functions.
Right.
What was the other one? The Gaussian?
The Gaussian.
Yeah. Yeah, that one's notorious too. Sure, being hard to approximate.
Right.
I suppose you can get very clever about these. Just if you know what value you're after, or if you have a specific function you're trying to expand.
Mm-hmm.
If you really wanted to know values of e to the minus t over t integrated, you could probably come up with all kinds of specialized things that do it.
Right.
I suppose.
It's cool that it's just really interesting that this after six terms gives much better convergence than it does.
The other thing, after 200 wasn't getting anywhere close yet.
Right.
So I wonder if some combination of the two might not be pretty good way to go.
Right.
I don't know. I mean, mathematically, probably knows how to do this, right?
Right. Yeah. Well, and then I have no idea what Mathematica's algorithm is. He's using it as a baseline to compare it to. Numerical people have thought a lot about how to...
Andy got into this for a long time. Factoring, products of big primes. He was developing all sorts of clever ways of doing it. Of course, everybody has thought of every possible way of doing it. So he got some pretty good estimates, but I don't think he ever exceeded what people are routinely able to do. It takes a lot of persistent effort to really make some progress. But and of course you could just integrate it numerically.
Right.
That might work. I mean, you've got an infinite range there, which could cause you some problems, I suppose. But when x is really big, your integrand isn't very big, so you can probably
truncate it.
Yeah, maybe so. Yeah, so you put a bound, so if X is bigger than, you know, a Google or something, you know, you come up with that nice approximation for that tail, use that for everything, and then just do your finite integration, your Newton's method or something out to
right.
X equal a Google, whatever.
Yeah, or Monte Carlo.
Yeah, all kinds of things. I don't know. You guys know much about numerical methods? Done anything with it? I don't know a thing about it. Ask Eric. He probably knows about that. Monte Carlo is used a lot in QCD, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I think anything with
lattice is used. Right. Yeah. Yeah. You know, do like a Monte Carlo sampling of paths or something. I don't know.
I think that's a really cool way of calculating something. You draw something and then you throw darts at it. And
yeah.
It lands in it, then you count it, and if it doesn't land in it, then you don't count it.
Right. Good. Anything else you want to present on this? Homework, compute the N equal 430 diagram, or come up with a way of approximating or bounding the number of diagrams at a given order. That'd be interesting. I don't know how to do that, but, you know, might be possible to do it. So let me just see what there is to say about this last bit of chapter 5. The running of the coupling cone. Good. All right. So the first thing I wanted to do was talk about this. What do we call it? Superficial degree of divergence. So the issue that we've come to, and we've started talking about renormalizable and non-renormalizable theories. And let's take a little bit closer look at that. There's a way that will usually tell you whether a theory is going to be renormalizable or not. So let's see if we can understand that. By the way, thank you, Jeff. Hold on. I would encourage each of you, I won't yet say require, but encourage each of you to find something you'd like to give a little presentation on like this. Whether it's something, further on in the book or a paper you're reading or, just some, calculation or idea you want to understand. I think it's a very good exercise to stand up and try and talk about something. It's very hard. And, great practice. This is why we do this for the candidacy exam here. You go out and read some papers and present them. Because, it shows that you can digest some sort of advanced material and present it in a coherent way. It's the sort of thing you need to be able to do. So, I recommend to all of you getting some practice at that. If you see something you'd like to look into or you want a recommendation of some, paper or idea to present, talk to me about it. We'll work it in. That gives me a break. Okay, so let's see. The first idea here is to look at higher and higher diagrams, and whether a graph is one particle irreducible or not. So you can have a line with what's this example we give. So you know, here we've got a three vertex diagram in a 5-4 series. So we get these guys coming off, and okay, so suppose that one is a tadpole that then spawns another couple of particles, and then up here we have another couple of particles, and you know, this looks like a fairly complicated diagram, but by drawing, by cutting one line, namely here, we turn it into some diagrams we've already analyzed. You know, this diagram is just a one loop diagram. We've already renormalized that. This is just a simple scatter. That doesn't even require renormalization. So a diagram like this doesn't add any new complexity to the theory. The kind of thing that might is if you, so let's try and find something that doesn't do this. So if we have, let's see, vertices like this, and you know, maybe those two come together, and how many do we need here? let's see, lots of particles in the final state, and how many vertices are we? We're talking about three vertices here, so something like that. We need another particle. Four. Did I get four at each vertex? Okay, so something like this, is that one particle irreducible or not? So if we cut one line, does that turn into something we've handled? So it's got one loop, but then it's got stuff coming off each vertex of the loop. Well, if we cut any one of these lines, any one of these internal lines, say we cut here, okay, now we've got something that's actually very simple. There are no loops at all. And so that's not going to have any divergences. So a single cut here reduces this to something we've handled, so this probably doesn't introduce any new infinities. I don't know. Can we do anything really bad? let's see. And can we get, let's see. Oh, we drew a diagram like this the other day. If we cut one of those, now it's a one loop diagram with a couple of extra legs. So this one's not a problem. But it turns out 5-4 theory is renormalized. But what we want to do is some, it turns out we can do some simple counting that will tell us whether we can do this reduction. If at all higher orders, the divergences we get reduce to ones that we've already renormalized, then the theory is called renormalizable. The other thing that can happen is you go to higher order, like I think with 5 to the 5th, it can get this bad. What you get are I don't know what you get. I've never tried to draw a 5 to the 5th diagram before, but it could be horrible. You could get a web here that I think has an awful lot of legs to it. So I don't know what you can draw for 5, but 5 is non-renormalizable. What happens is that okay, you go to second order, you find all right, you've got like some loops and you renormalize all of your fields and stuff, and you make that finite. Now you go to the next order in perturbation theory, and you find you've got some new types of divergence that come up. And so you renormalize things again, and now everything converges at that order. And you go to the next order, and it happens again. And if you find that you have to renormalize all the fields at each order of perturbation theory, that the theory is called non-renormalizable. In effect, to predict an exact result, you would have to do an infinite number of measurements to fix all those initial constants before you can start making predictions. Maggiore points out that in practice, you know, you go a few diagrams up and you're getting pretty good approximations, you know, whether the theory is renormalizable or not. So that for practical purposes, that's not necessarily an insurmountable difficulty. You can still make some predictions even at that, just like the asymptotic series. You know, converges after 3, well, you know, who cares if it starts to oscillate wildly after 100? This is not a problem. So these are all valid methods of computation, you know, that it gives you what you need to compute. But what we'd like to do is develop a simple criterion, because we can, it turns out, for telling whether these theories are going to be renormalizable. And one way to do that is by counting our divergences. So let's count this is called power counting. So if we have a propagator, a propagator goes like 1 over p squared minus m squared. For large momentum, that's going like 1 over p squared. So we bring in a negative power of the momentum effect. For a loop, we have an integral over momentum, d for q over 2 pi to the fourth. We have to integrate over a propagator. Now, where do we get these things? Okay, we get a propagator for each internal line. So if ni is the number of internal lines, remember, the propagators from the external lines cancels with the original expression. Let's let L equal the number of loops. So the divergence is, what happens? If we just integrated that, it would diverge like 2 to the 4th, or lambda to the 4th. But if we've got enough propagators in there, that's going to suppress it. So the superficial divergence of a theory is 4 times the number of loops, because we have momentum to the 4th in the numerator, but then we get to subtract 2 times the number of internal lines. Alright, so if that number is non-negative, then we're in danger of having a divergence. We're, almost surely going to have a divergence. Now, even if that's positive, it's possible that other parts of the theory produce cancellations, like in supersymmetry, you have this situation. If this number is negative, it's possible that things combine in just such a way that you still get divergences. So it's not an absolute thing, and you need to look, to be certain, you have to do some detailed calculations with the exact theory. But this is a good indicator. This usually will tell you. So let's figure out what happens. For example, in phi of the n theory, we want to relate the number of loops to v equal the number of vertices. Okay, because at each vertex we're going to get like in 5 to the n theory, we're going to get n particles out. So if we know how many particles can come out of each vertex, we can relate to these different numbers. So let's write L in terms of the number of vertices. Well, okay, so how do we do that? Well, related to that and the number of internal lines. Okay, so let's look at some examples and see if we can sort this out. So we've got something that, you know, say we're in bi-tree theory, where we can try and draw these things a bit. Each time we add a vertex, we're going to add two lines. And so we add another vertex and we add two lines. And let's see. Adding a vertex in this theory adds one line. Right? You add a vertex and what was one line becomes two. So we're always adding one line when we add a vertex. Now, if we add a loop, what happens? Okay, so suppose we've got a vertex here, we've added one line, but now if we add a vertex that gives us a loop, there are actually two lines that come into that vertex. That changes the number by one. So, let me see. I had this all figured out this morning. It was working great in my head. Why am I not seeing it? Here's the formula. The number of loops is equal to the number of internal lines. So internal lines are just these guys. And there's an internal line. That's clearer. Because when we add a vertex, if we're holding the number of external lines fixed, then each time we're creating an internal line, then we subtract the number of vertices plus one. Does that make any sense? So the number of loops is the number of internal lines minus the number of vertices plus one. Does anybody see why it works?
V is vertices then?
V is the number of vertices.
Okay.
So suppose we've got four vertices. Well, how many internal lines do we have? Well, if we're in 5-3 theory, right, we can connect it up like that. That gives us four internal lines. Four vertices plus one is one loop. Okay, it worked here. If we add another vertex here, well, then what?
You still added an internal line there. So
I've turned one internal line into two. So I've added an internal line, and I've added a vertex, but I haven't changed the number of loops. Okay, that's good. Yeah, so each time I add a vertex here, I'm adding one internal line. So those can go up step. But now, suppose I add a vertex, or let's see, I add two vertices like that. So I've added two vertices here. What have I done? That's given me three internal lines. By connecting two of these, I've added one more internal line here, and that increases the number of loops. So So now that difference is one because I connected two of these vertices with an additional internal line. So that increases the internal line one faster and gives me one more loop. So now I've got two loops. Yeah, all right. Starting to see that. This is a quite general formula. Let's try it with n equals 4 and see it working there. So we've got a vertex, and now we're going to send off three things. And, all right, let's send one to the wasteland. Let's send another here. So we're going to get three particles like that. So here we've got one internal line and no loops. Let's see. So we've got one internal line, two vertices, no loops. So far, so good. But now, if we bring these guys, suppose we bring these guys together, what have we done now? I've added a whole slew of internal lines. One, two, I added three internal lines, so now NI is one, two, three, four internal lines. I've got two loops. That difference, how many vertices? One, two, three vertices. Three vertices. And the difference plus one is two loops. Okay, so topological stuff. So, spend as much time as you like, playing with diagrams on your napkin and, see if you can further convince yourself that regardless of the theory, right, each vertex is going to add a bunch of lines. If you just add a vertex, you've only added one internal line. So one vertex, one line, you're not creating loops. It's only when you connect that at some other vertex that you're creating more internal lines. And that's what's going to produce a loop. Okay, so starting to see that. Good. So, all right. Two more. We're getting there. So we can write L in terms of the number of vertices. So the divergence we can now write as 4 times the number of internal lines minus 2 and I minus 4b plus 4 is, what do we got? Twice the number of internal lines minus 4 vertices plus 4 is the superficial divergence that, just counting our integrals. Okay, now, suppose we have lambda phi n3. All right, that's our interaction. Then each vertex is going to connect n lines, little n lines, some of which may be internal, some of which may be external. And the thing I have to do is count which. Let's see. So if we tally up, right, each internal line comes off two vertices. So, all right, let's see. How many, if we have n vertices, wait a minute, which is which here? Do it. Phi n theory. Hold on. N lines at each vertex. Okay. So, we have n times the number of vertices equals the total number of lines. But really, okay, at a vertex, if we've got an internal line coming off, that's also going to land on another vertex. Every internal line, both ends, land on a vertex. So this is going to be equal to, we count the number of internal lines twice and the number of external lines once. So the n times the number of vertices has to equal the number of external lines plus twice the number of internal lines. And that allows us to replace D is, all right, so we replace, we have 2 number of internal lines minus 4 times the number of vertices, which is, wait a minute, which way am I going here? I want to do it the other way. I want to use this to get rid of the number of internal lines. So the apparent divergence is going to be, right, we have 2n, but 2n is equal to the number of vertices plus the number of external lines here, minus 4 times the number of vertices plus 4. So we have n minus 4 times the number of vertices plus the number of external lines plus 4. Are my signs right? No. What did I do wrong? Minus. So twice ni is equal to n times the number of vertices minus the number of external lines. Okay. There's our point. Now, what's it telling us? So, in lambda phi to the nth theory, we've got, you know, n phi fields produced at each vertex. We'd like to know whether we're going to get divergent integrals or not. And we want to know order by order in the number of vertices. So D is the order in perturbation theory. Okay, so if n is bigger than 4, then if you keep adding vertices, you're adding something positive always. And eventually, this is going to go positive pretty quickly, probably. So theories with n greater than 4, so 5 to the 5th theory that we started drawing a picture of there, that's going to be non-renormalizable because we expect to be adding one power of momentum in the numerator each time we add a vertex. The number of external lines, okay, you know, suppose we've got 10 external lines, so we have to wait until you've got 6 vertices, but everything after that, you're going to have a positive divergence. So you can expect lambda phi fifth theory or lambda phi seventh or 17th theory to be non-renormalizable. On the other hand, if n is 4, then as long as you don't have too many external lines, you're okay here. Or no, the more external lines you get. So the more complicated the interaction, the better. Right? The more particles you send in or the more that come out, the more convergent all these integrals will be. So as long as you have more than 4 lines, well, we've already handled the case where you've got 4 external lines. You know, we've looked at that. So 2 and 4 external lines, we get 2 renormalizations. After that, we're done. We start adding vertices, they get better. When n equals 4, this doesn't contribute. So adding more vertices just doesn't change the result. So, but we have those 2 divergences when we have, well, if we have 2 or 3 or possibly 4 external lines, we could have some divergences and we've handled them. In phi cube theory, this term is negative So it just makes the conversions better and better and better when you add vertices. So that's going to be well behaved. But if you produce too many particles at each interaction, things are likely to diverge. Well, this isn't too bad because none of the standard model symmetries allow more. If you remember from gauge theory, right, what do the interactions look like in gauge theory? So we've got a field strength that looks like D of a potential plus a commutator of a couple of potentials. Right? Any Yang-Mills theory? Any Yang-Mills theory. Right? And the action, you know, we have F A mu nu contracted, then we've got some killing metric here. So the action, the self-interaction terms look like this. Well, at worst, that two of these commutators multiplied, that's a four field interaction. So, okay, so gluons can interact like four or a vector of this and that cross, you can have three. You can have vertices like that. And then the interaction with some spinner fields, you may have a multiplet of spinners. And let's see, what's going to happen? You've got a gamma mu, you've got a set of vector potentials here. You've got probably a psi bar C, and what's going to happen is probably something like a structure constant there. So the kinds of interaction, okay, that's a cubic interaction term. Not going to be a problem. So the standard model interaction, can be renormalizable theories. And they do turn out to be renormalizable too. So that's it. There's one interesting feature here. If you look at the consequences, if you track back into the action and look at what's happening in the action for your interaction terms. Suppose we have an interaction Hamiltonian where the interaction is, lambda phi n. We have something like this. Then we've got d4x. Okay, if n is greater than, all right, when do we run into trouble? When n is greater than 4, we're definitely running into problems here. Well, the units of phi goes like 1 over a length, right? It's a momentum. It has scaling weight minus 1. So phi to the n goes like 1 over length to the n. So the scaling weight of this, the volume form, is 1 over length to the n times length to the 4 is length to the 4 minus n. Well, where have we seen that? N minus 4, right there. So if these together, if n is bigger than 4, this goes like 1 over length to the n minus 4. If n is bigger than 4, then in order for this to be dimensionless, the Hamiltonian to be dimensionless, the units of lambda have to be length to the n minus 4 to balance the factor. So if n is greater than 4, you have a dimensionful parameter with units of length to some positive power. So dimensionful coupling constants, in particular with positive scaling dimensions, are the ones that are going to lead to non-renormalizable theories. So it'll be renormalizable if all of your coupling constants in the theory have units of like powers of 1 over length. If they're dimensionless, you're probably okay. N equal 4 here is renormalizable. So the units of the coupling constant turn out to be a good guide to whether a theory is renormalizable or not.
And in general relativity, have 1 over L, is that right?
In general relativity, the let's see. He actually says here, what is it? The unit of the Newton constant. That's the coupling constant. Let's see. Where did he mention this? Hello, where'd it go? I don't know. What are the units of the Newton constant? It's probably like a
cavitation of something?
Yeah, the cavitation of something.
Like
what are the units?
1 over m?
Yeah, so gmm over r squared is a force, right? That's the mass times an acceleration. So the units of g are the same as units of r squared times acceleration over mass. And mass goes as 1 over a length, so we get a length from this. R makes that a length cubed. Acceleration is meters over seconds squared, so that's 1 over meters, so 1 over length. So the units of g in h bar equals c equal 1 unit will be length squared. So that's the positive power coupling constant. So general relativity can be expected to be non-renormalizable. Let's see. You know, people go to different actions for gravity. Sometimes they'll write a curvature squared action for gravity, and it turns out that gives a renormalizable theory. You know, the problem is it doesn't give general relativity, which is known to be the right theory of gravity. Helps to, you know, whatever number of significant figures, an increasing number of significant figures. So that may or may not be satisfying. A conformally invariant theory, of course, will have only dimensionless quantities at the fundamental level. That should be fine. Then the question is where you actually introduce units. And, that's worth looking at. I think we should think about here. In projecting to, I'm thinking by conformal space here, if you project to the configuration space, the by conformal space, everything you write is going to be dimensionless. The volume element is dimensionless, unlike here where the volume element goes like d4x. If you started to do integrals, I've erased it, but our divergent integral for our loops, we were introducing d4k. Well, if they were loops in phase space, you'd be integrating d4k, d4x, and that's dimensionless. So, you know, nothing ever brings in any dimensions until you project to one or the other of these submanifolds, when now the volume element becomes dimensionful, and that may be the source of the problem. I had another thought about this. Let's talk about the cosmological constant thing here. Enough about all this. Any questions on this?
I have a question, but I think I just proved the L thing. In general.
Oh, good. What's your proof?
Well, if you build a matrix using a Boolean logic with the number of vertices across the top and the number of lines on the bottom and only allow 2 vertices for each line, then by Boolean logic, you can see then loops are defined as anything that are Booleanly dependent or one-to-one goes to zero. So there'll be Booleanly dependent for each one.
Therefore, you cannot have more than that independent. And by the fact that you're using Boolean logic, that is the actual number. It pinches it on both sides.
Tempted. I'm not sure if I followed it. Did
you?
Yeah.
My God, of course.
Well, 1 and 0 show me a lot of options. So if three things up go up and add up to 0 or 2, then as you add the columns, you're going to get every loop falling out. And since you've got a matrix,
what do I write down here? Tell me what my matrix.
Okay, draw a matrix with the top axis being 1 to V. The top axis is 1, so 2, 3, 4.
This is V?
Yeah, that's going V this
number,
direction.
Number of vertices, okay.
Okay.
And then we want to
and then on this direction, you got number of Ni.
Number of internal lines.
So by definition, an internal line will have at least 2 vertices it is touching.
Yeah.
So when you build this matrix, the way you get a loop is having any linear dependence between your NIs. So if two NI or a group of NIs are linearly dependent, using a Boolean algebra, they will be a loop because you've now gone around a circle because you've gone back to the same point. I've got the longer proof.
Okay.
Down here, but
okay,
right. So
you get loops here somewhere,
right? So as you go through that, anytime when you add it together, it goes to 0. You've got at least one that equals a loop.
So let's see, if I start somewhere,
right?
Each time I add a vertex, I'm spinning out a line. So I'm adding lines and vertices together.
Right.
Right. Until I come around to close it. And let's see what happens then.
Then your first and last line up. At each point you're gonna have 2 1s. If you only use the internal lines that are going to line up, correct?
Yeah, so 1 and 1, like that?
No, because...
Only the internal lines, okay. Each internal line.
Has a point there and there.
One vertex. Here's one internal line.
Right.
So...
And then that one's got...
Here's the second vertex and the second internal line.
Right, and that first vertex is touching the 1 and the 2. So on that first line you have a 1 and a 2 with 1s in it, and everything else would be zeros. Then on the next one of this chart you've got up here would be like...
So
the first one would be 1, 2. 1 there.
1 here.
Yeah, 1s and 0s are all that are in the matrix, actually. So you have 1 and 0.
Okay, so what do I put here?
A 1, because it's touching that vertex.
If
that line is touching that vertex, you put a 1. If it's not, you don't put anything.
So if this line touches with their two vertices,
right.
Which one?
You've got one vertex. Each number is a vertex. So, like, you're actually doing each scale has to be a different matrix. Okay, I'm not explaining it well. Let me.
Once you go up there.
Here.
Yeah.
I think I've said it.
Yeah.
So, if you construct a matrix for each diagram, such that, so here we've got vertex 1.
Yeah.
And we've got line 1, and we'll go 2, 2, 3, so on, which is 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So this one. So 7. So yes. 1 is going to have a 1 here, and then a 5, 6, 7, and a 1 and 7. This one, this first line is touching 1 and 2. 1, 2, so you got 1, 2, and the rest are going to be 0. Does that make sense?
Oh, this is vertex number 1.
Yeah, 1, 2, 3.
Oh, okay, so we number the vertices.
We number the vertices?
Okay.
We build this matrix.
So,
now anytime
we number the internal line. Okay, alright.
Anytime this adds up to...
Yeah.
And any time using Boolean algebra means that if you have 2 1s in a row, and we put, say, those three together, then these are going to add together. 1 plus 1 equals 0.
Yeah.
And then you got 1 1 linearly dependent using Boolean algebra. So anything linearly dependent using Boolean algebra is going to make a loop. Because you've got the vertices being touched by that algebra. Is that...
Yeah,
by that?
I may have seen it. Okay, so...
So now,
so the first vertex, or sorry, the first internal line touches vertices 1 and 2.
Right.
The internal line number 2 connects vertices 2 and 3.
Right.
Internal line number 3 connects vertices 1 and 3. And your claim is that those three vectors are so linearly dependent under mod 2 addition. So they're going to close into a loop. Yeah.
So and that argument holds. We did it combinatorics. I could prove it later. So once this argument holds, then you go and you say, all right, how many linearly independent? Well, if you've got only three vertices, and then we know from basic linear algebra that you can't have any more than three independent things. And by using this new algebra system, that gets rid of one.
Yeah.
So your algebra system gets rid of one, and then just the dimension is the other, the rest. So it would be Ni for the minus Z is our original, and then the plus one for the Boolean logic.
Where does the plus one come from?
Because right here.
Yeah.
Whenever you have this closed to itself.
Yeah.
You're using Boolean logic, so that would normally be true.
Yeah.
And so now it goes to zero, and so that means that since you're using log two, you have to add one here. It works over there.
Right, I know. I do that every day.
But you get what I mean. There's at least this much, and then this much I think comes from the Boolean logic.
Yeah, this seems like a good way to graph it. Okay, so to see how you do the division here, if you've got, let's see,
I think we actually did that problem when I was making combinatorial matrix.
Yeah. So yeah, what we're getting is, you know, we're getting a cycle here, right?
Right.
Yeah, the first one connects 1 to 2, the second 2 to 3, the third one connects 3 to 1, and that's a loop.
Right.
And you can tell that by doing mod 2 addition on these columns. The sum of those three rows is zero mod 2.
Mod 2.
And, yeah, that's probably the key that you close the cycle.
Right.
So each closed cycle is going to be a loop. Now, so otherwise, each internal line.
No, you don't have external lines there, so they're all going to have at least two entries.
Yeah. Exactly two.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. So there are two ones for each internal line.
So with exactly two entries, that means that.
Yeah, and you have to use up all the internal lines, right?
Right.
Because otherwise they'd be external.
Be external.
Yeah.
And so at the end, there we go. Okay. So you can reduce anything to a 3x3, and it's all again. That's how it is. Because if you get bigger, everything else is going to reduce, and you know you're going to be left with this. And there is no way to write a 3x3 without a loop. Or n by n without a loop.
Right. Now, if we have more vertices, so let's see. You're always going to have fewer vertices than internal lines, right? Because each vertex is going to have at least three lines, or it's not a vertex.
Right.
Yeah. So are we out of time?
No,
that's interesting. Yeah, that's how I
Type it for you.
Yeah,
I can do that.
Yeah. So, we're sort of done with chapter 5 anyway. You know, the one thing that I wanted to talk about is this cosmological concept thing, which you can read yourself. But the point is that the cosmological constant is one of the things that needs to renormalize. So if you've got the Einstein tensor stress energy tensor plus the metric, and we're using his funny signature here, then the expansion of the universe, you've got this line element, F squared is his signature, D squared is minus some
scale factor times the spatial metric, we call it sigma squared. It could be flat or whatever, but you're interested in this thing, and the acceleration, the relative acceleration of the scale factor in cosmology. I think most of you have probably done this solution at some point or other. Is minus 4 pi g over 3 g over 3 times rho plus 3 times the pressure. Well, you know, what this is, that's a trace of T of B, right? The stress energy tensor is mass density, pressure, pressure, principal pressure, right? For an isotropic homogeneous universe, you have a stress energy tensor like this. And its trace is what comes into this formula for the relative expansion. You've got a minus sign here, so this is going to be a decelerating thing. The presence of matter tends to slow down the expansion, maybe bring it to a stop and relapse, or maybe just sort of slide off to infinity. But if you have this, the trace of this factor is minus 2 lambda. So now, with the cosmological constant, you've got this negative contribution here. So it may expand to a point and matter gets really dense, and then at some point, if the density drops enough, then things are dominated by this cosmological constant. R double dot over R now is positive, and things start to accelerate. So a positive cosmological constant can drive a late time expansion of the universe. And, you know, this is not a hard solution to do, and you can, you know, easily solve the Einstein equation and do this explicitly. But, you know, this is what they're now seeing. A careful study of the type 1A supernovas with Hubble has given really good measurements of this, and this cosmological constant is like 0.99% sure to be there. Not zero. So what we expect for the universe now is this late time acceleration where, you know, rather than, you know, just slowing down forever and, you know, gliding apart or actually recollapsing, it's, you know, just starting to a point where it's going to start to take off again and expand faster. So that seems, you know, in the standard model picture of what's happening to be what's happening. What Fanfiori's concern is in the vacuum expectation values. You know, so you've got some, you know, expected value of the matter density for, you know, stuff in the vacuum. So, you know, even if nothing is out there, this, as we saw with the simple harmonic oscillator, you know, you get this A dagger A plus a half, you know, H bar omega for the energy, and we integrate over all, you know, this is our energy, something like this. Well, and the half term diverges, then we put in normal ordering to get rid of that. Well, so what's happened to normal ordering? It's been obliterated by our time ordering because we're just trying to do these time projections. So, you know, even if you normal ordered our interaction Hamiltonian, we still have to reorder everything to do the time ordering when we do the Dyson series. So so we're back to having the problem of vacuum energy. Well, he claims general relativity, you know, the gravity responds to any energy that's present. I'm not so clear that this is actually present. but, you know, never mind. This is the standard argument. So if we have to worry about this large vacuum energy on the order of, I think he gives an estimate of, say, 10 to the 48 for that, you know, it's a big number because, you know, there's a lot of vacuum out there. You know, then, you know, this vacuum expectation value gives rise to a cosmological constant, and a very large one. So what you do, well, what you do is you prepare to renormalize the cosmological constant by vacuum expectation. So your effective renormalized cosmological constant is
lambda 0 plus this vacuum expectation value of your matter. And, okay, so regular renormalization prescription, you say, oh, I'm going to choose this thing to give the renormalized value here. The thing is, when you look at the actual numbers, it's bizarre. If you do this for the mass of the electron, the renormalized mass of the electron is the usual 0.5 MeV. And what that is something like M0, plus, you've got a log lambda kind of term here that's a correction. And, this term turns out to be something like, maybe a tenth of the of M0 or something. I mean, it's logarithmic. It's a very small number. Even if you take this lambda to the Planck length, this still turns out to be a fairly small correction to the bare mass to come up with the actual measured mass of the electron. So you think, this isn't so egregious. Of course, you take lambda to infinity, and it's an infinite renormalization. But never mind. Standard argument here. What happens here is that this thing needs to be on the order of 10 to the minus 3 or something. And, each of these is on the order of 10 to the 48, or 10 to the minus 3 to the 4th, I think. It goes like to the 4th power. So what you're doing is you have to choose lambda 0 to cancel 10 to the 48 to, parts in 10 to the 60th. So the cancellation is really, really fine-tuning in this case. Well, it's finer tuning than this fine-tuning, but of course, lambda infinite is still lambda infinite. So infinity minus infinity in the lambda goes to infinity limit is also extremely fine-tuning. But still, that's finer tuning in some sense. So people regard this as a problem. And one would like to know why you get this, very precise kind of cancellation so that this number comes out so small when this number is so big. The only other case this happens is with the scalar field. The only real scalar field is the Higgs particle. So the Higgs particle also has a very large discrepancy. We saw with scalar fields that there's a lambda squared divergence, right? It's not logarithmic. It was like lambda squared. We did that calculation. And so the renormalization of the Higgs particle mass is something that's also a very large thing. It makes me wonder whether there's some relationship between the Higgs particle and the cosmological constant.